Hey, it's 4:06. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a look at a new technology that could replace animals in some kinds of laboratory research.
First, conversations about the end of life can be difficult. And while these conversations are an important part of what doctors do, being a good doctor doesn't actually mean that you're trained at how to best have those conversations.
Well-known physician and writer Atul Gawande realized that he himself had difficulty having those end-of-life conversations with patients, so he set out to observe what his colleagues do in those situations. The hope was that he would be able to answer the question, what matters the most when your time becomes short?
The result is a new Frontline documentary called Being Mortal. It airs tonight at 9 on your local public television station. The producer of the documentary, Tom Jennings, is here with us now to talk about it. Tom, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you.
Well, in the documentary, you ask the question, what matters the most when life becomes short? How do we even start to answer that question?
It's so terribly personal. But I think the point really is that we often put that kind of question off. It's a little too big, perhaps a little too vague. It's something that we don't really want to think about at all. I think the problem is that what happens is that we start asking those questions at the moment when there's a crisis, and that often really is just a little too late.
How do doctors begin to figure out what that means for each patient? As you said, it's something that's incredibly personal. So what's sort of the beginning part of that conversation?
The beginning part is something that's actually rooted in a kind of medicine that's been around. It's fairly new, but it's been around for at least two decades and goes back even further. It's called palliative care medicine, and a lot of people associate it with hospice, but palliative care is a subset of medicine that's unto itself. It deals a lot with pain relief, but it also is done by trained physicians, trained in and practiced in end-of-life conversations. And so they actually have a very strong framework for asking questions, very specific questions that seem very simple. But the whole idea is to get the conversation out there, to establish what people's priorities are at the end of life when there's no more life to live. I mean, the question is really, what do you want to do? What are the goals that you have, except for living longer? What can we do in the time left? And then let's start catering and designing our treatment based on those goals.
Now, in the beginning of Being Mortal, Dr. Atul Gawande watches other doctors tackle this question. What are some of the roadblocks he sees to asking people, even, you know, he has trouble with this himself, but asking people about their end-of-life wishes?
Well, I think it's so interesting because it's so relatable to all of us. We all have the same kind of problems. I think we also feel that the doctors who deal with these kinds of issues on a daily basis should probably be a little more accustomed to dealing with it. But the problem really is that they have this sense of being the fix-it people. They have the ability to fix problems. The question is, what happens when there are no more cures and they don't have anything else to use to fix things? What happens then? What kind of conversation do they have then? They're at a loss oftentimes. And so they find themselves as perplexed and hard to embrace the reality of the situation of these patients that they're often very deeply involved with.
Do you think part of this is changing some assumptions about the end of life? And one of them might be that everybody wants to live as long as they possibly can, no matter what. Is that something that needs to shift?
Yeah. that's a bit of an existential question, but I think that's really largely what comes into play here. You know, it's really not just the doctors. It's a two-way street. I think we have to accommodate ourselves as people and patients, or patients-to-be. You know, we have to be the people to embrace the idea that there's a certain limited capacity to our own lives, that we do have an endpoint. And the sooner that we can embrace these kinds of discussions, the more likely it is that we're going to actually have a smoother landing at the end. There are a lot of studies now that do support this. Just having this very simple discussion, recognizing the reality that there's a finite time left, there's a lot of studies that show that people actually live better at the end of their life. And strangely, this is the oddest thing, they actually live longer.
Why do they live longer? Because they're honoring their true wishes and not just life extension?
I can't really say exactly why, but if you think about it, there's a certain kind of logic that's at play here. If you decide to have a conversation and then that conversation leads you to go into, say, hospice earlier, that means that you're taking yourself out of treatment. And if you're taking yourself out of treatment, you're taking yourself out of exposure to what are oftentimes, you know, toxic therapies. And every time you do another treatment, you're offering up with the potential for some kind of complication. Oftentimes, you know, at this stage of life, there are complications. And so once you remove yourself from that whole matrix, suddenly it's just kind of an organic ending. You don't have as much suffering, potentially. I'm not saying it's always the case. But the studies do show that people are not only happier at the end, they seem to be living healthier at the end. And by doing all of that combined, they actually have longer life outcomes compared to those people who have not entered into these discussions early. It's fascinating work.
Well, we have a clip here from Being Mortal of Dr. Atul Gawande speaking with the husband of one of his patients who was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer. She had been diagnosed late in her pregnancy and had done a lot to try to prolong her life. And Dr. Gawande here is speaking about his own conflicting role in this.
When I came on the scene was when she got diagnosed with a second cancer. You know, in my mind, what I was thinking was I wouldn't offer this surgery because the lung cancer is going to take her life. And yet I didn't feel I could say that to you all. I think we started talking about the experimental therapy that you all would like, were hoping to get on for a trial with the lung cancer. And I remember saying something I sort of regret, which was, you know, maybe that experimental therapy will work for the thyroid cancer, too. I knew it was a complete lie.
And this gets at something that doctors experience, like you said, wanting to be the one to fix things to make it better and have to admit to themselves and their patients at some point that they can't make it better. There is no fix. This is the end of life for someone. I'm curious if there is a bit of a moment going on among medical professionals right now, taking a look at how to have these conversations and how best to have them.
I feel that there is. I feel that the success of Atul's book, you know, Being Mortal, the same name that we gave the film, is a testament to that. It's been at the top of the bestseller list ever since its publication in October. I attribute it partly to Atul's, you know, strong sense of kind of what the social needs are in society. But I also think that we're now at a point that we're willing to have these kinds of conversations. We're willing to explore them, and we're past, you know, the death panels, and we're past the politicization of you know, making these kinds of decisions. Not completely. There'll always be these issues that come up and pop up, but there's a certain kind of sense of growth, I think, that's happened, and a willingness to embrace things, to talk about these issues that we just haven't seen before. It really does feel like we're on a certain precipice looking into something new.
And as you said, this involves patients, too. There are clips in the documentary where it's clear that the patient themselves isn't ready to acknowledge this, but the healthcare provider feels that they have to. They have to take that step, and it's sort of a delicate balance that has to be struck. Is there any kind of training, really, that can prepare anyone for a conversation like that?
Yeah, actually, there is. I mean, I think there's definitively a kind of training that people can go through. I don't think that anybody is really saying that every doctor in America has to be a palliative care doctor, you know, credentialed. And I think that people who are actually palliative care physicians, you know, doctors who are trained in this, are the ones who need to go into the most difficult situation. But I think that what Atul is really trying to get across, and what we're trying to say in the film, is that it's a kind of conversation that has a sort of rudimentary aspect to it. It's just very basic. It's simple. And the effects are very profound. And even if doctors are able to embrace that simple conversation and break through, you know, beyond the sense of them wanting to be the fix of people, then it's going to be a net positive for everybody. But I don't want to lay it all on the doorstep of the doctors either. I think we all have to kind of look into this. And there are a lot of communities, even in Wisconsin, I know, that are very progressive about this. It's a fascinating phenomenon that seems to be happening.
Tom, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We've been speaking with Tom Jennings, producer of the Frontline documentary Being Mortal, that airs tonight at 9 on your local public television station. First, a technology in development at the University of Wisconsin and elsewhere around the country aims to mimic human tissue in scientific research.
If successful, the so-called tissue chips could help advance drug testing in a way that's not currently possible with use of research animals. For example, drugs that work on lab rats can still be toxic to humans. Tissue chips could help identify these toxic drugs before they're used on people.
William Murphy is a professor of biomedical engineering and orthopedics and co-director of the Stem Cell and Regenerative Medicine Center at UW-Madison. He's one of the researchers working with tissue chips. Bill, welcome to Central Time.
Good to be with you.
Well, starting with the basics, what are tissue chips?
So the tissue chips are essentially these glass or plastic chips that have individual human tissues growing on them in very, very small pockets. So in essence, we have micro-scale human tissues that are forming in individual spots on a chip.
And is the idea that these can mimic different systems or organs of the body, say the brain?
Exactly, yeah. So these are designed to mimic really critical components of human tissues, including, for example, the developing brain. And really, we're not developing tissue that would resemble exactly the structure and function of the human brain. That would be awfully complicated and very difficult to do on a micro-scale chip. But we can recreate really critical properties of the brain that are important for understanding whether a chemical is toxic to the brain.
And probably, you know, I won't understand the complete answer here, but how do you go about doing that? How do you get a slide of glass to mimic a human brain tissue?
Well, you know, we start with stem cells. And stem cells, as I'm sure you know, are cell types that can multiply indefinitely, and they can also differentiate, which means that they can turn into cell types that are useful, that are part of the adult human body. And so if we control what those cells are surrounded by, which means either the soup that they're sitting in or perhaps the matrix that they exist within, then we can control how they differentiate and ultimately how they form into a human tissue.
Now, in terms of the applications of this, what are some of the problems with the current testing method, usually animal testing, that tissue chips could improve?
Well, I think there's a variety of potential applications, one of which, as you described, is toxicity testing. At the moment, when rodent models are used to understand the effects of toxicity on the developing brain, the studies that are done are called multi-generational studies. And there, a rodent, for example, a mouse, would need to be exposed to a chemical, its offspring would be studied, and their offspring would be studied. And so these kinds of multi-generational tests are quite expensive, and also aren't very highly predictive of what happens in the human. In fact, in some cases, the rodent models are poorly predictive even of what happens in a larger animal, like in a rabbit. And the predictivity in those cases can be in the neighborhood of 50 or 60%, which obviously is not very helpful if we're trying to understand the effects of toxins on humans. And the idea here is that because we're starting with human stem cells and we're forming human tissues on a chip, they can be better predictors of what happens in the human system.
Are they better predictors so far?
They are so far. And in fact, we just finished a few months ago completing a test of 10 blinded compounds. So these were compounds that at the start of the experiment, we didn't know whether they were toxic or non-toxic. And we were able to predict in 9 out of 10 cases correctly whether a chemical was toxic or non-toxic. So in that particular study, the tissue chips were 90% predictive.
Are these tissue chips difficult to grow, or, you know, mice are easily available? Is this something that would mimic at least the availability of that kind of sourcing?
Yeah, you know, the technologies and the techniques that we use to make these tissue chips are not that highly specialized. So the kinds of materials that we generate that allow these cells to form into the tissues that mimic human tissues and the cell types that we're starting with can be generated by potentially lots of labs. So it's not something that has such a barrier that it would only be something that could be performed by one or two groups. This is something that can be done by lots of groups.
So it sounds like there's lots of pluses. What research is yet to be done before this kind of tissue chip is available more widely?
Well, I think one of the things that we have to do is screen a much broader cadre of compounds. So we've screened a limited number of compounds to date, and as I mentioned, the system has been quite highly predictive and really promising. But there are tens of thousands of compounds that we want to understand the potential toxicity of. And it turns out that of the chemical compounds that are produced in the United States at over a ton a year, I believe approximately 93% of these have never been tested for toxicity to developing brains. So there's a whole lot of tissues, there's a whole lot of toxins or potential toxins that we have to be able to screen. What that really means is we have to be able to scale these systems so that they can be what we call high throughput. They can screen lots of compounds in a very short period of time and at relatively low cost.
So 93% haven't been screened before. Why not? Why has it taken till now, till you've got this tissue chip to start doing this?
Well, in part, we haven't really had the tools to do those kinds of screens. The multi-generational tests and rodents that I mentioned earlier are prohibitively expensive for industry to be running these kinds of tests. So the companies that are producing these chemicals, in principle, could be required to do a multi-generational test in rodents, but it would be so expensive for them to do so for all of the chemicals that exist and that are produced in the United States at high quantities that it hasn't been required.
Now, this work that you're doing with tissue chips, it's not just being done here in Wisconsin at the UW. It's being done elsewhere in the country. Where are some of the hot spots of tissue chip research right now?
Well, there's a large number of groups that are interested in this area, and there are now at least two national initiatives that are focused on developing tissue chips for high-throughput screening types of applications. One of them is a National Institutes of Health initiative that is called the Microphysiological Systems Program. It's actually a partnership between the National Institutes of Health and DARPA, which is the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. And this has funded now about 20 different groups from around the country to develop tissue chips in different sorts of organ systems. So there are groups that are trying to develop mini heart tissues in a dish. There are groups trying to develop mini liver tissues, mini skin tissues, mini skeletal muscle tissues. There's a whole range of them. And really the very ambitious goal of this national initiative is over the next several years to generate on a chip 10 different human organ systems communicating with one another in the way that they would communicate with one another in the human. So they would have a vasculature, they might have an immune system, they would be really good predictors of what happens when a drug or a potential toxin enters the bloodstream of a human.
So does that mean you'd essentially have a human body on an array of these tissue chips?
That's the idea, is to create chips that at that very small scale can mimic what happens in the human body. Now, it isn't going to be a human body, and oftentimes we think about these individual tissues on the scale of microhumans. So we might need to develop and build these systems so that they have a similar capacity to human organs. So, for example, the liver is not the same size or capacity as the brain. They have different numbers of cells. They have different metabolic rates. There's lots of things that are different about these organs. So if we made the mini liver and the mini brain the exact same size, they probably wouldn't match very well. So that's one of the engineering problems here, to try to match these systems such that they mimic the human system, but they have the ability to be scaled as well so that we can look at lots of potential toxins and lots of drug candidates.
Now, if tissue chips come to be widely adopted, if the testing and the development moves forward, what would that mean in terms of the cost? Would there be a net savings?
Oh, in principle, it could be a tremendous net savings. And I think maybe it's most dramatic when we think about drug discovery. So on average, when a pharmaceutical company develops a drug, they might start with 10,000 lead compounds and ultimately develop one drug. And that process of drug discovery and development might take 10 to 15 years, and it might cost in the neighborhood of $1.2 billion. That's a tremendous cost and also quite a long time frame for development of these compounds. If you had a human mimic system outside the body where we could short circuit that process and get better predictive values for drug safety and potential drug toxicity and potential drug efficacy, whether or not it's actually going to be effective and achieve its goal, then we might be able to do this at much lower cost. At the moment, that process of drug development might start in a rodent model and make its way all the way up to a non-human primate before going into a human system. That development path is tremendously costly.
Bill, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with William Murphy, co-director of the Stem Cell and Regenerative Medicine Center at UW-Madison. He's one of the scientists developing tissue chips that could one day replace animals in scientific research.
We're talking about the latest news on the Brian Williams controversy. Last night, Lester Holt took over hosting NBC Nightly News, role usually filled by Williams. Here's what Holt had to say about Brian Williams' absence.
We want to take just a moment to tell you where Brian is tonight. In a message to his colleagues over the weekend, Brian told us he's taking several days off this broadcast amid questions over how he recalled certain stories he covered. In a career spent covering the news, Brian told us it's clear he's become too much a part of the news while this issue is dealt with.
The story in question is about Brian Williams coming under attack in a helicopter in the Iraq invasion of 2003. Here's a clip of Williams telling that story on David Letterman in 2013.
We were in some helicopters. What we didn't know was we were north of the invasion. We were the northernmost Americans in Iraq. We were going to drop some bridge portions across the Euphrates so the 3rd Infantry could cross on them. Two of our four helicopters were hit by ground fire, including the one I was in.
No kidding.
RPG and AK-47.
Paul Levinson is with us now to talk about this story. He's a professor of communications and media studies at Fordham University. He's also the author of 15 books, most of them about the media. Paul, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure.
So you're watching the story. You've been quoted on it. When did this Brian Williams story first start to come into question?
Well, just really very recently. And that's what happens with these things. A lot of times people say things that aren't quite true, but nobody is paying attention. But then one fine day, someone is. And, you know, in this case, there obviously were people on the helicopter that did take fire, and they knew Brian Williams wasn't there. What's not clear is how long they were aware of what Brian Williams was saying, because we don't even know every single time that Brian Williams made this claim. We do know that shortly after the event, he told the totally truthful account of what happened, and it was only in the ensuing years that somehow this got mixed into a recollection that it was his helicopter that took fire, as you heard him saying on the David Letterman show. And it's unfortunate. One of the things I've been saying, and I think it's important for people to bear in mind, this is not a case of a reporter making up a story out of whole cloth, or a reporter or a news anchor investigating a political candidate and bringing into the investigation some questionable sources, which is what happened with Dan Rather and George W. Bush. This is essentially a personal recollection. And we're often fuzzy with our personal recollections. We often embellish them. But unfortunately, Brian Williams has a special responsibility because he is a news anchor, and that's what's created this situation for him.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of talk from psychologists about how this kind of maybe selective memory, gradual memory editing can be pretty common. We've seen politicians bounce back from this sort of thing, but this is a journalist. Reliability is kind of their stock in trade. Is this something that a prominent journalistic face can come back from?
I don't know. It's a tough situation. Every profession has certain bottom lines that the people that the professional serves have a right to expect won't be breached. So if, for example, you go see a doctor, you expect the doctor to get your diagnosis right. It may be the human thing to do to occasionally make an error, but if a doctor misdiagnoses something, or even worse, a surgeon cuts out, you know, the wrong part of the body when you're going for surgery, that's going to be it, you know, in terms of that person's career if people find out about it. And unfortunately, we do expect a higher level of truth-telling from our news anchors. But that said, I do think that given the fact that, as I just also said, Brian Williams didn't just make this up out of whole cloth. He was flying over Iraq. What will determine whether or not he'll survive is whether or not there are any other cases of this kind of misrecollecting or misreporting. So NBC is correctly looking into various other situations that Brian Williams covered, such as Hurricane Katrina. And if it turns out that this is a pattern, then I think it's a hopeless case for Brian Williams. But if it turns out that this is the only misrecollection that he had, I think there's a better than 50-50 chance that he could survive this.
Well, here's the apology that Brian Williams gave on NBC Nightly News. This is earlier this month.
I made a mistake in recalling the events of 12 years ago. I want to apologize. I said I was traveling in an aircraft that was hit by RPG fire. I was instead in a following aircraft. We all landed after the ground fire incident and spent two harrowing nights in a sandstorm in the Iraq desert. This was a bungled attempt by me to thank one special veteran and, by extension, our brave military men and women, veterans everywhere, those who have served while I did not. I hope they know they have my greatest respect and also now my apology.
A lot of times when you hear an apology like that, there's a hope that that's the end of the story. This clearly was not.
Well, one of the reasons that's not is we live in an age now where anytime anything happens with a public figure, you have a plethora of tweets and all kinds of comments and photographs on social media. And so for that reason alone, it's almost impossible for a story to go away. But there's another thing as well. There was a folk singer, not well enough known as he should have been, in my view, in the 1960s by the name of Phil Oakes. And he had a wonderful song called The Crucifixion. And he was talking really about the assassination of John F. Kennedy and why people took such an interest in every single element of it. What was Jackie wearing? What was the expression on her face? And one of the points that Phil Oakes made, and it's a pretty stunning point, but when you think about it, it's true, is that the public enjoys the decline of the very icons that it builds up. And they're quick to jump on a situation where someone who they held in very high esteem does something that's wrong. It doesn't mean that the person who does something wrong should be exonerated, but it does mean that once this gets going, it begins to feed itself. I've seen, you know, all kinds of clever photographs on Twitter. Brian Williams was at the Yalta conference. Brian Williams, here he is during the Civil War talking to some Union generals, and, you know, they Photoshop his face and image into those photographs. So it has taken on a life of its own. Ironically, though, I think that if Brian Williams does come back after not too long a time, this very negative interest could result in greater and better ratings for the NBC Nightly News, because I think more people are interested now in Brian Williams than they were before.
Now, we in the media are covering the story, talking about it right now. Are we more interested in this than the public as a whole is?
No. I mean, I think that the public as a whole is very interested precisely because this is a person who talks to us, or at least millions of Americans, every night. And this is something we've known for a while. I mean, you know, it goes back actually even before television. It goes back to radio in the 1920s. The first time that you had something from the outside, a newscaster, coming right into our living rooms, right into our bedrooms, right into our kitchens, and we almost feel that these people are members of our families. You know, we listen to them in the car when we're driving. I'm sure there are people listening to this show right now in the car, and from a psychological media point of view, it's almost as if our voices are in the car, and we are in the car with those people. So because of that, anyone who has seen Brian Williams, and most Americans have, they feel they have a relationship with Brian Williams, and that's why they're so interested in this story. It's almost as if a member of the family or a friend or a colleague at work has gotten into this situation.
Is that true now, as it might have been a couple, few decades ago, now that some of us might get our news from Brian Williams or his colleagues on the other networks, some of them get the news from an acquaintance on Facebook?
Well, absolutely, things have changed. You know, back in the 1970s, a Gallup poll reported that Walter Cronkite was the most trusted person in America, which even back then, I was, you know, barely more than a kid, I thought was a little strange, because after all said and done, I liked Walter Cronkite, but I had no idea whether what he was saying on television was true or not. But he had that kind of very, you know, trustworthy persona. We've come along way since then. I think even before this incident, no one in America would have said that any news anchor, including Brian Williams, was the most trusted person. And yes, we don't get our news as much from the networks as we used to. In the heyday of the networks, you're talking about 50, 60 million people watching a nightly newscast. Now, all three of them put together, maybe we'll have 15 million people, if that much. I think that's a healthy thing, though, because what has happened is that we now get our news from so many different sources that we have a better way of knowing whether something is true or not. We don't just have to rely on a handful of sources.
We're talking to media expert Paul Levinson about the Brian Williams controversy.
And we want to know what you think. Is the media blowing the story out of proportion? Have you personally lost your trust in Brian Williams or news anchors maybe in general? Do you think Brian Williams should be able to come back to the host seat at NBC Nightly News? Call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation now about Brian Williams and whether or not he's lost the trust of the American public because of misleading statements he made about being under fire in Iraq in 2003.
And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Do you think Brian Williams should continue as the host of NBC Nightly News? Do you think he can be trusted as a journalist in the future? Do we hold news anchors to a higher standard? Should we? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Go right to a caller. We've got Dick on the line in Mount Horeb. Hi.
Hi. Just a quick comment. You know, if you trusted Brian Williams before this episode, I think you still should. You know, I think it's unfair to criticize him for misremembering this 12 years down the road, and a lot of people that are criticizing him certainly have never even been in an experience anywhere near what he went through. I mean, if you're in a convoy of helicopters and one of them gets hit, certainly the whole convoy was under fire. So, you know, as he says, the fog of memory, I don't think he was looking for any more attention than he had already gotten. He just misremembered it. And that's my comment.
Dick, thanks a lot. Interesting perspective. Maybe, Paul, we can forgive someone for getting things wrong in what was originally probably a stressful, uncertain situation.
Yeah, look, that's why this is such a tough call. I, for example, I've never been in combat, but during the Vietnam War, I was protesting the Vietnam War, and I went to several marches on Washington, including the march on the Pentagon in 1967, and people there were tear gassed and charged by U.S. troops, and I certainly breathed in tear gas, but I wasn't charged by U.S. troops, and no one threw a tear gas canister right in front of me. But over the years, as I've told that story, I sort of say, well, hey, right in that March, you know, I was tear gassed, which is technically true, but not 100% true. But the problem, again, with Brian Williams is that he's not just another person who came under fire or didn't come under fire. He is a news anchor on one of four major networks. That, I think, does carry a higher responsibility. So I think that the scrutiny that he's now being put under is justified. Whether or not he should continue, I think if I had to make the decision, I would probably say give him a chance as long as nothing else comes up.
What's the line in journalism? If your mother tells you she loves you, ask for two corroborating sources. As a journalist in this case, before someone like Brian Williams shares an anecdote, a memory, is it journalistically responsible to double check his own memory?
Well, look, the problem is, you know, in regular situations where you're not reporting on what you recall, you do usually insist on more than one source. You know, there's another old joke about a guy at a radio station who gets a call from a drunk saying that there's a fire someplace in town, and the caller is a known drunk, and so the person at the radio station is trying to confirm it can't, and then goes on the air and says, and now we have a report from a usually unreliable source that there's a fire on 33rd Street. So it's tough. You do need to corroborate. And probably when you're dealing with your own recollections, especially in a situation like that, you especially should corroborate so that you're not played false by your very recollection.
Go to another caller now. We've got Doug on the line in Waukesha. Doug, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have heard from a couple of different sources that Brian Williams did have a story that is suspected to be false at Katrina. Something about he drank the water, that he saw a body float past while he was staying in the French Quarter, that the water got into the hotel he was staying in the French Quarter, and people were saying, no, that we were there in the French Quarter. It was one of the highest places. This didn't happen. My question is, why weren't the people who were sent with Brian, his news crew, pulling him off to one side, saying, Brian, these stories you're telling, they're not putting you in the best light. This didn't happen that way. Why didn't he have a core group of people around him pulling it and saying?
Gotcha, Doug. Paul, I've heard that is one of the stories that NBC is now looking into to see if this is a one-off or if this is a pattern. But this is presumably a guy with people around him. Would they have some responsibility to be a check on what Brian Williams is out there saying?
Well, here it's important to distinguish between a public official, a president, a governor, even a mayor, a senator on the one hand, and a newscaster on the other hand. People who are in public office do have people around them who are constantly checking to make sure what the politician, what the public official says is accurate and correct, because politicians also basically depend on the public trusting them. But the truth of the matter is, Brian Williams doesn't have a body man or a minder who follows him around to make sure everything he says is true. When he's actually doing his newscast, that's the result of a group of people who are very carefully preparing and vetting all the stories. And that's why, again, there's an important distinction between a news story and a recollection that someone who is a news anchor communicates to the public. And in case of the recollection, people are just not paying that kind of attention to what he says.
Now, with this NBC investigation, what should they be looking for? How much due diligence do you think they need to do at this point?
Well, at this point, the last thing that NBC wants is to do a superficial, sloppy job, and there's no reason to think that they will, in investigating Brian Williams and say, well, okay, there's nothing else that Brian Williams ever said, which was at all incorrect. Only a month later for someone else to come up and out with something that says, well, hey, Brian Williams got this thing wrong with Katrina or on some other trip or some other story he was publishing. So my guess is NBC is going to do a very, very thorough, exhaustive job, and they're going to consider all of these things. You know, the Katrina, I looked into it already to some extent. It's not impossible that Brian Williams saw that. What is the case is the hotel that he was in a part of the city where there wasn't that much flooding, but there was still some flooding. So what I'm sure NBC is doing is trying to find out were there any bodies tragically floating in the water that Brian Williams could have seen when he was in that place at that time. And maybe there'll be other witnesses who will say, yes, there were. If there's nobody else who can corroborate that, and furthermore, there's some kind of reason to conclude that there were no bodies anywhere near where Brian Williams was when he made that report, well, that's not good news for him.
You mentioned earlier the rapport between Brian Williams, somebody in his position, and the people who watch him maybe every single night. Just looking at internet comments for what they're worth, yes, there's been criticism, but there have been a lot of people saying, this is an honest mistake, I'm not going to watch until Brian Williams is back on the air. Do you think that there will be a lot of those people who already feel that connection and will say, hey, I'd cut a friend or family member some slack, I'll cut Brian Williams some slack?
Yes, absolutely. I think Brian Williams is a very likable newscaster. He's not someone like Bill O'Reilly, where, I mean, some people love him too, but, you know, he's a very irascible personality. Brian Williams comes across as a good-natured, warm-hearted person, and I think he does have a lot of admirers and a lot of fans, and there's no doubt that they'll stay behind him. If no other negative examples arise.
Now, you have been studying the media and journalism for a good long time now, but what was your personal reaction when you heard about this story?
I was surprised because, you know, like everyone else, I assumed that everything Brian Williams said publicly was true. And I've met Brian Williams a couple of times. He was at Fordham University a few times for various events. And from what I can tell, and actually I've been following Brian Williams even when he was on MSNBC reporting the news before he became the anchor on NBC. What's clear to me about Brian Williams is if ever there was a person who loved his job and loves his job, it's Brian Williams. I mean, he really got into the role of news anchor and made that position his. So I was, you know, shocked when I heard about this and actually aggravated because I feel bad that this is happening to him. And I hope that he can get through this. I would be very happy if a week from now he's back on the air and all of this fades away.
Paul, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Paul Levinson, professor of communications and media studies at Fordham University. He's the author of 15 books, most of them about the media. We've been talking about the ongoing story of NBC Nightly News anchor Brian Williams. Keep sharing your thoughts over at the Central Time Facebook page.